When I was a young staffer on Capitol Hill, I met a man named Stephen Breyer, who was a law professor at Harvard. I thought, very smart, he'll probably be an academic the rest of his life. But actually, he became a justice of the Supreme Court and has been in that role for 27 years. I recently had a conversation with him about his future and about the future of the Supreme Court. I have to start with the question that's on everybody's mind, obviously. Why is this book that you've just written so small? It's a very small book, and I'm used to bigger books. So why is this book so small? I mean, why didn't you get a bigger book?
This is the Constitution, and it's smaller.
Okay, all right. A lot of justices of the Supreme Court carry around the Constitution all the time. Is that because you're going to forget what's in it, or are you... You just like to remind people, or you just read it over and over again?
You never, never know when somebody's going to ask you a question, you see. Somebody says, what does Article 3, Section 19 say?
Okay.
And they expect you to know.
Okay, so you have
it. So you have it here. Yeah, there
right,
it is.
There it is. Your book, this book is a interesting book in the sense that it came from a series of lectures you gave named after somebody who was an ideological, let's say, opponent of some of your views, and that was Justice Scalia. So were you a friend of his, even though you had ideological differences?
Yes, I think so. We would debate those differences, and we'd go, I thought we had a terrific debate. In Lubbock, Texas, there were several thousand students who'd come. They'd never seen a Supreme Court justice. And we talk about our differences. You know, I say, hey, if I had your theory, my goodness, do you think George Washington knew about the internet for free speech? Do you think he knew? And Scalia would say, I knew that.
Well,
good point. Then he would say, I'm not saying my theory's perfect. He would say, you know, the two hunters, they're hunting bears, and one's putting on his tennis shoes, where are you going? And he says, bear's coming. He says, you can't outrun a bear. He says, yeah, but I can outrun you.
Right.
See, that was his view of my way of deciding cases. And I still, 28 years now, I've never heard a voice raised in anger in that conference room. I've never heard one justice say anything mean or
nobody
even snide
at the table or anything like that.
What good would that do? I try to explain that to the students. You know, you get all excited, and all that happens is people disagree with you, think, well, you know, he's all excited, he must be wrong. And that's so true. So we get on well personally, and we're friends personally, and we disagree on some things, not as many as you think. But some.
It's not always been the case. There was a Supreme Court justice who refused to talk to or be in the presence of Justice Brandeis because he was Jewish.
McReynolds.
Right. So it hasn't always been that friendly.
No.
But you're saying right now, since you've been on the court 28 years, people don't yell and scream at each other.
Mm. And they don't insult each other, and they're not rude to each other. And it's a professional job, and you go in and do your best professionally. And if you want people to listen to you, the best you can do is to think through this problem. Listen to where the other person is coming from and see what you can contribute to that thought.
But sometimes the dissents are a little bit tough on the person who wrote the majority opinion. Nobody takes that personally.
I get that question a lot, and I used to get it more when Nina Scalia was on the court. And the two of us would be there, and somebody would ask that question, and I'd try to answer it because I didn't want him to. And I'd say, look, I know you're not aiming that question at me. You're aiming it at Nino. Okay, I get it. But what you don't understand is that some people suffer from a disease. It's called good writer's disease.
Okay.
And if a good writer finds a felicitous phrase, he won't give it up. Let him destroy himself, let the world come to an end. It's like a good comedian. You can't give up that joke. Now, that's Nino. He is a very good writer. He has a felicitous phrase, and we all know that, and we don't take it personally.
Do you have a lot of unanimous decisions these days, or they don't get that much attention? And do you really have a lot of 5-4 decisions, and they get all the attention, it seems, but is that where the court really has its arguments with each other, the 5-4 decisions, and
No, not necessarily. What you read about are the ones that the press thinks the public will be interested in, which usually has a political or a social content. And they'll say, that's the most important. I don't know. One of the most important decisions I wrote this last year was called Google versus Oracle.
Right.
And it took a year for me to write that. It was about copyright and something called interface programs. And I was told that that was very, very important. Well, for me, it was like learning Latvian. I mean, I don't know how I did that. But you see, it's I'm not saying all the, I see what they're saying. I see what they're saying. And it's true that a lot of the sort of exciting cases are more close.
But do the justices, let's suppose you have a decision, it's 5-4, and will one justice kind of go to another justice's chambers and say, you know, your argument isn't so good, and maybe you should do something different, or is everything just done by memos and writing, you don't have people going down the hall and saying, let's have lunch together, and maybe I can persuade you my position is better than yours? Does that ever happen?
Most of it is memo, but quite a lot can be visits to chambers, but if I'm going into your chambers, I'm not going to say, no, your argument isn't so good. This would not be a helpful way to start the conversation. And if you go into somebody else's chambers, you better be prepared to listen to them, as well as hoping that they will listen to you. And then you try to see, and that's what I learned in the Senate, that's what you try to see is, where is there some common ground? And is there common ground enough that you can work with it?
Let's go back to your earlier life. I worked on Capitol Hill, and you worked briefly on Capitol Hill. You were a Harvard Law professor. I'm just curious, when you go to Harvard Law School, and you're at the top of your class, when you start Harvard Law School, there's always kind of an intimidation factor. You have 600 people, you have to figure out, you know, are you going to be good or not? When did you realize you were really good at law school kind of things, taking exams? Did you know right away you were going to be a great law school student and therefore become a potential law school professor? Or were you nervous the first year or so?
I think I was pretty nervous. I mean, I remember talking to a friend of mine I'd been an undergraduate with, and he was there too, Paul Dodick, actually. And we both said, well, this is the end of our great careers. That was after our first year. And we both did pretty well in law school.
So you were in the Harvard Law Review. And when you're on the Harvard Law Review, sometimes you get to clerk on the Supreme Court for another justice. And you clerked for?
Arthur Goldberg.
And what was that like?
It was terrific. He was great. He was an enthusiast. He had loads of energy. Jack Kennedy said that he was the smartest man he ever met.
So you clerked for him, and then you went to teach at Harvard Law School.
That's right.
And when you went to Harvard Law School, did you say, this is going to be my life? I'm going to be a professor, nothing terrible about that. You can teach great law school students and so forth. Or did you say, maybe someday I'll be on the Supreme Court, maybe I'll be a judge? Was that in the back of your mind?
I didn't think maybe someday. Anybody who thinks maybe someday I'll be on the Supreme Court, I mean, I don't want to say there's something wrong with him, but there is something wrong.
Teaching at Harvard Law School, you got a very good reputation. Senator Kennedy invited you to come down and work on his staff, I think to work on regulatory reform.
Yes.
And that's where I first encountered you, and I was working on Capitol Hill and so forth. You got a very good reputation. And then something happened that was a surprise to people. President Carter nominated you to be a judge on the First Circuit. And that's not a surprise, given your reputation and so forth. But it required a Republican to sign off on it, Strom Thurmond, one of the most conservative Republicans. Why did you think Strom Thurmond said he would let a presumably somewhat liberal Harvard Law professor get on the First Circuit?
I mean, those were days. It was a different day. You remember that. People did try to work together. Right. And every single morning, Ken Feinberg, who was like, I was chief counsel and he was a general counsel or something of the Judiciary Committee. And we would have breakfast with Emory Sneeden, who was a former JAG general, and with Strom Thurmond's chief person on Judiciary. And we would plan the day. We planned out the day. We wanted no secrets. We wanted to try to accomplish something. And we'd figure out, how do we color it red for this party and how do we color it blue for the other party? But the important thing is, if it's desirable, let's try to get it through. That happened a lot. I can't say there was no conniving, but Ken and I and Embry used to call what we did open conniving, openly arrived at.
Okay. So you went on the First Circuit, and you had a very good reputation there, and then you were being considered to be on the Supreme Court. And so you came down for an interview with President Clinton, but you had a bike accident, and you had a lot of injured bones, if I recall. So did you think that was bad karma, that you had this accident before you had the interview, and did that affect your ability to do the interview well, or it didn't make a difference?
I have no idea. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. And later I thought about it, and of course the newspaper people wanted to say, weren't you terribly disappointed, da, 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 da. And I said, I'll tell you why. I said, well, you know, it's not such a terrible thing in your life to be seriously considered to be on the Supreme Court, even if you're not appointed. And that's about the best you can do. And I was thinking, partly I said that because it's true. And partly I said it because I did have children. Hey, my friend, you don't always win everything you want. And my goodness, what do you want those children to learn? And you want them to learn fine. Sometimes you'll get everything your heart desires, not very often. And sometimes you won't. And you better be a good sport about when you don't. So, as well as when you do.
Well, Mick Jagger has a song about that. You can't always get what you want. And so
right.
You didn't get it.
That's after my generation.
Okay. So Justice Ginsburg was appointed first, but then you were appointed next by President Clinton.
Yes.
So when
yes.
you got on the court, how had it changed from when you were a clerk? Was it much different? And were you surprised by the changes?
Yes. I thought it was different in this respect when I clerked. I felt it was a court with a mission. What mission? In 1954, the court had decided that Plessy v. Ferguson, rightly, was down the drain. And legal segregation is contrary to this document, equal protection of the law. They said it in 1954, and we both know what happened in 1955. Nothing,
right.
Next to nothing. 1956, yeah, double nothing. 1957, a rather brave judge in Little Rock said those Little Rock Nine, those nine brave black students are going into that white school, Central High School. But the governor, Governor Faubus, said maybe those students have a court order, but I have the state militia, and they're not. And Eisenhower, I'd like to see that at the monument that they're building for him. He called in 1,000 troops from Fort Bragg, the 101st Airborne, and they took those nine black children and walked into that white school. No, I'd like to say that's the end of the story, but it wasn't. What happened was after a few months, the troops had to withdraw. And when that happened, the school board said, we're not going to integrate anymore. And when that happened, a very famous case went to the Supreme Court, Cooper versus Aaron. And when that happened, all nine justices signed the opinion saying, integrate now, do it right now in Little Rock. Hey, but there are nine people. Maybe there could have been 900, maybe 9,000. Faubus closed the school. That's what happened, for those of us who remember and those of us who don't. But they couldn't keep it closed, because that was the era of Martin Luther King, the Freedom Riders, and suddenly the North woke up, and others woke up and said, this is an intolerable situation, and eventually, through a lot of work and a lot of moral effort and a lot of physical effort and a lot of organizing effort and so forth, eventually legal segregation was brought to a conclusion. And the reason that I find that story important. And I told that story to a woman from Ghana who is the Chief Justice, who is trying to improve constitutional system there, and asked me, why do people do what you say? And my response was, ma'am, 301 million people in this country and 300 million are not lawyers. That comes as a surprise. And those are the people you have to convince. Convince what? Convince that they should try to follow the courts or the rule of law when they don't like it, when they think it's wrong. And that's why I wrote this book. In a sentence, that is why I want people to see in some detail. It's not moralizing. It's my experience. And I want them to see what the court can do. But when you say the court can do, it doesn't mean nine people. It means the country as it's come to develop a long time, 200 years, and then maybe we have a country that can use this weapon called the rule of law in order to prevent some pretty terrible things.
Let's talk about what's called the shadow docket. For people who are not lawyers, what is the shadow docket and why is it becoming such a big thing?
What it is that in between hearing the cases on which we have decided to hear, someone will make an emergency motion. Now that's what it is, an emergency motion. The country is divided. I'm in charge of the First Circuit, for example, but everybody's in charge of some circuit. So if there is a litigant in the First Circuit who believes that he needs immediate attention to issue an injunction or to stop an injunction, well, then he'll file it with me, and I'll look at it, and if most of them there isn't much to, and so it's easy to deny it. But some there is something to, and then I usually will refer it to the whole conference. And if I should have and didn't, he can go to any other judge and it will be referred to the whole conference. Most of these that are the subject of the whole conference are death cases, and at the very last minute. Because of COVID, I think, there have been some recent cases which did not just involve the death penalty or something that wasn't too difficult. And there I thought I was in the dissent in those cases.
Well, the most recent abortion case.
I was in dissent. I thought it was wrong, and I thought we should have heard the whole thing. It was a procedural matter. They didn't decide the substance of the statute.
But there will be a case presumably working its way up to the court, but it might take a year or so for a...
There is a case in November where that's the subject matter.
You've been on the court now 28 years. What are you most proud of having done? And what's the pleasure of being on the Supreme Court?
It's a great privilege to be on the court. I mean, there's no doubt. And from a personal point of view, I'd say it requires you in middle age, when you get there, to give your best to this every minute. And you say, is that a big virtue? Yeah, yeah. And the older you get, the more you see it as an enormous virtue.
Einstein famously said, if you try something over and over again and expect a different result, that's the definition of insanity. So if somebody asks you a same question over and over again, expecting a different answer, I guess that's the definition of an insane interviewer. But let me ask the question you've already been asked many, many, many times. Mm-hmm. I know you're not going to give a different answer, but I have to ask you the question. What is your thinking about all of the issues relating to your retirement?
Yes.
Okay.
Einstein was right.
Einstein was right. Okay. So you have said that you don't want to die on the court, and presumably nobody would want you to die on the court. So what do you...
It's Einstein is coming back.
So what is it that you would like to do when you are alive after you're off the court? In other words, would you like to go teach again? Would you like to write? Would you like to just take life easy? What would you like to do?
It's hard to take life easy, but I don't know. We'll see.
Okay, so you haven't thought about what you might want to do? Or
no. Different thoughts things. Go through my mind.
President Biden has put together a commission that's going to look at the court, and you have already articulated your view that you don't think expanding the size of the court is a wonderful idea. I think you've said that.
What I've said is that they better be pretty careful about it, because two can play at that game. And of course, what's worrying me, and I say this, I try to explain to people in the book the extent to which politics is relevant or not relevant or not present, and in what form in the work of our court. And what worries me is that people will think we're junior league politicians. And if they think that, the first, second thought should be, why don't I have a senior league politician? And once you begin to think along those lines, two can play at that game, as I said. You could have Republicans appointing and then Democrats appointing and vice versa. But I see the overall tendency of that is, given the history, given the way we work, given the country, et cetera, as weakening the confidence of the average person in the decisions of the court. And you can say, what's wrong with that? And I say, well, that's sort of a step towards or away from a rule of law.
What would you like most people to know about the Supreme Court? If you could say to the average citizen, here's what you should know in a paragraph about the Supreme Court. I assume, you know, it would be something along the lines that it's not as political as some people think, but what would it be you would say?
A judge, once he puts on that black robe, I'm not going to say it's a midnight transformation, but look, a judge, and I have to think this about myself there too. I have to. A judge is there for all Americans. He's not there just for Democrats. He's not there just for Republicans. He's not there just for the president of the party that appointed him. And even if half the country thinks he's a real idiot and they can't stand what he writes, in his own mind and the way he approaches the job, he has to remember he's there for everybody, all 331 million.
Thanks for listening. To hear more of my interviews, you can subscribe and download my podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen.